Okay, well, I get to begin with the introduction to model theory. So first of all, let me thank Matthias and Patrick Speisiger for entrusting me with this duty, and I hope I am sufficiently entertaining. And I'd also like to thank David Marker, who's not here and had nothing to do with this, but he gave a very beautiful set of lectures with a very similar command at the program at MSRI on the model theory of fields 10 years ago, and I've followed his lecture notes with great attention. That's not to say I did the same thing, but at least I really felt that he did a beautiful job, and I hope I can live up to his standards. Let's see. So Matthias promised that I would arrange to meet my group of students, so here's my arrangement. At the end of the reception this afternoon, I suggest that we meet in the fourth floor area outside of on the fourth floor by the blackboards, and since I'm first, I get to claim that spot. So we'll meet there at 5 o'clock or whenever it is that the reception is coming to an end. Okay, so of course I'm giving an introduction to model theory here, and I have to cover I'm assuming I'm starting with nothing, and I'm hoping there are at least some people here who've never seen a logic course, because if everybody's seen it before, well, don't tell me, because otherwise I'll get nervous and I've already planned what I'm going to say. So I want to really, but I'm going to be covering essentially, in the first lecture, I'll be covering the ground of the first undergraduate course in logic, and in the second lecture, I'll cover roughly the ground of the first graduate course in model theory. So we'll be going very fast. That means I have to give lots and lots of definitions, so I apologize for that, but we just have to have them. And I'm going to try to keep this very firmly grounded in examples, and in the examples which are, I hope, most relevant to the study of O-minimal geometry, so really keeping it focused on where we're trying to go with the model theory. So let me start by thinking of the real numbers as an ordered field. And I want to think about some of the things that we say about the real numbers as an ordered field. So, for example, we might say, for all x, y, and z, if x is less than y, then x plus z is less than y plus z. Okay, that's something that we can say about the reals as an ordered field. Or we might say, for all x, if x is greater than 0, then there exists a y such that y times y is equal to x. So every positive element has a square root. I might say, okay, those are things about, well, this talks about the relationship between the ordering and the addition. This tells us something about existence of square roots. We could say that, I won't write this out formally, but we could say every odd degree polynomial has a root. All right, that's something that's true about the real numbers. We might also say every bounded set, every set bounded above has a least upper bound. That's something which is true about the real numbers as an ordered field. Okay, so what do we have to use in order, these are the kinds of standard mathematical things that we would say about this structure. What do we need in order to do so? Well, of course, the first thing we need, just looking at what I've written here, the first thing we need are variables. I've listed named variables and said something about them. So we need to have variables. Now I gave different kinds of variables up here. In fact, I didn't name the ones in the last statement. But the first one, I have x, y, and z, and they range over the real numbers. So I have variables which range over the set that I'm talking about. So x, y, and z range over the reals. On the other hand, in the last statement, I said every bounded set, and I could have given that set a name, so every set A which has the property of being bounded above, has the least upper bound. And in that case, I have the variable A, which is ranging over a subset of the reals, so ranging over all subsets of the reals. So I have, let me call it A, even though I didn't put it in there, A ranges over subsets of R. And the very first thing I'm going to do is to disallow the second kind of variable. So I'm going to take this out. We'll be talking here about what's called first order logic. And in first order logic, I only allow my variables to range over the universe, and I don't allow them to range over subsets of the universe. So this is something that I'm not going to allow in my logic. And so this is something that I can't say. I'm not going to be able to say that in the logic that I'm using. And I'll say right at the end of today's lecture, if I make it, or this morning's lecture, this first lecture, more about why we make that restriction. Right? But we do make that restriction. Okay, so having left that out, then so far I've got variables ranging over the universe. I have functions. I said for all x, y, and z, I said x plus z is less than y plus z. So I have a function which I've included in my things I can talk about. So I have functions. In this case, I have two functions. I have the addition function, which is a binary function, and I have multiplication, which is a binary function. So I have those two functions. I have relation symbols. I have this symbol, which is the ordering. I actually used it in two different directions, but I could have got around that. So I have relation symbols. And I also have the equality. So I said less than, I said equals. I have a constant. I have a zero. I talked about the number zero, which is a particular element of the set that we're looking at. So I have the constant zero, and I might very well also have talked about one. I could have said something about one. I have logical symbols. I have the implication. I could have talked about and or. I could put things together. I could put negations. I could say something is not true. So we have the connectives, logical connectives. So implication and or negation. And finally, we have the quantifiers, for all and there exists. And again, for all and there exists range over the set that we're talking about. So I have these elements which make up the things that I say mathematically, and we break them into two groups the way I've done here. These are the logical symbols. And whatever we're doing, we always have those there. We're always going to be using logical connectives. We're always going to be having quantifiers there. These are more particular to the context in which we're working. And here we're talking about an ordered field. And so we need to be able to talk about addition and multiplication, about the ordering, and so on. So these are ones which are particular to the context. And now I'm going to take the equality and move it over here. And I'm always going to assume I'm working with equality, because if you don't have equality, it's not very interesting. Okay. So equality I consider as being a logical symbol, and it's there. We always have it. And then over here, I have things which are particular to the context. And so we call this thing a language. So a definition. A language, which I'll always call L, consists of relation, function, and constant symbols. Of a given arity. So I'll have L, right, L is R1, R1, R2, etc., F1, F2, etc., and C1, C2. Okay, so a language simply consists of a bunch of relations for which, for every relation, I say this is a binary relation or it's a ternary relation or whatever it is. A bunch of function symbols for which, again, I say what they're, how many variables each one takes, and a bunch of constant symbols. And that's all. It's just, it says this is a, the right way, the material that we need in order to talk about a given mathematical structure. So, some particular languages that we're going to use all the time. We have the language of rings. I'm going to use this all the time, so I'll give it a name and I'll call it L sub R, which R just for ring, and that consists of, and I usually don't write in that order, so I will not, the addition, the multiplication, the constants 0 and 1, and the ordering less than. No ordering. It's just the language of rings. Okay. But, or then I might add the ordering, in which case I call it the language of ordering, ordered rings. I'll call that L sub OR for ordered ring plus times 0, 1, less than. Okay, but I could also have others. I might, if I just wanted to talk about groups, I would only use one operation symbol, so the language of groups. I won't be doing this much, so I'm just listing it for the example. Language of groups would be, say, times and 1, constant symbol for the identity. Or the language of fields, I might want to insist that I'm talking about structures in which every element, every non-zero element has an inverse, in which case I would throw in the inverse function. So I would have plus times inverse 0 and 1. That would be the language of fields. So each, depending on the what we want to talk about, we put in the symbols, the function symbols, the relations, the constants, which are relevant to what we're doing. But let me emphasize that in doing so, this is just a language. It's not saying anything about the properties that those symbols have or the interaction they have with each other. It's just saying, if I want to talk about a field, I need to have an addition and multiplication. I need to have a 0 and a 1. It doesn't say the 0 is the identity for the addition. It just says it's there. So we have to put in that further information, we have to do it as a separate step. Okay, so but once I have this setup, then I can start to build things with it. So once I have a language, then I build terms. So the terms, and I'm not going to write down a formal definition of terms and formulas. They're available in lots of different places if you want to ask for them, but let me just say briefly and informally. So if I use this board, can people read it? Yeah? Okay. All right. So terms are defined recursively. So constants are terms and variables are terms. So constants and variables, so let me just say, okay. So built up from constants and variables using the function symbols. Okay, so if I'm working in the language of fields, then I might say, I just build things together. X times Y plus 1 times 1 is a term. I just build it out of what I have. And I'll allow myself to use parentheses wherever it's useful, so I could put in times Z. Okay, so the terms are anything that we can build out of the symbols of the language in the obvious way. So in the case of, say, the language of rings, we can see that basically what we can build up as terms are polynomials in the variables, right? With coefficients which are basically, the way I've set it up at the moment, positive integers. So I can use the 1 to build any positive integer, and then I can use that as a multiplying any product of variables. So what I'm doing is just creating polynomials. Right, so in the language of rings, the terms are polynomials in finitely many variables. Then we use the relation symbols to make assertions about the terms. So I can say something about some combination of terms is equal to 0, or is less than 0, or is less than some other term that I've built up out of the relation symbols. So out of the terms, we go on to building up formulae, so an atomic formula is a relation applied to terms. So I just say x times y equals z plus 1. All right, so I take some term and I make some assertion about the way the terms are related. That would be an atomic formula. And then in general, formulae are built up recursively. By applying all of the logical connectives and the quantifiers to the atomic form to the ones I have already, applying logical connectives and quantifiers. So the examples that I wrote down at the beginning are examples of formulae in the language of ordered rings. Okay, so far this is all very formal. We want to give it context by saying where it's happening. So we take our language and we can make sense of it. Does this board stay up?
No.
This one doesn't? Okay, it won't work on it. I don't need this one. Okay, so then here's a key definition, a structure. So in order to understand, to give meaning to all the things which so up to now are just formal symbols, we need to interpret them in a particular structure. So a structure consists of a universe. So a structure, for a language, for a particular language, L, is, and I'll write it M, recursive M for the structure, a Roman M for the universe, and then the elements of the language I'll write out is a set M, which is the universe, over which the variables range. And an interpretation of all the symbols of the language. Okay, so I actually say what I mean by the symbol in each case. So back here again, if I have the language of rings, then an example of a structure for the language of rings would be the real numbers. So let me write that as cursive R, as the structure consists of the set over which the variables range, and then the interpretation of the symbols. So plus, as interpreted in R. And this is the first and probably the last time in which I'll write this, but just for clarity, we sometimes need to. Plus superscript R means the addition symbol, this is a formal symbol in the language, and this is its interpretation in this particular structure as the ordinary addition on the real numbers. Okay, times interpreted in R, 0, which is the 0 of the set, and 1, which is the 1 of the set. And that's an example of a structure for the language of rings. Now, I could interpret those symbols in some completely different way. I can interpret those symbols by any function at all that I want to. So I could interpret the addition symbol as x times sine of y. And I could interpret the multiplication symbol as something else, e to the x plus y. I mean, anything. I can interpret them in any way I want. I'm not saying anything about, I haven't so far said anything about what they're supposed to mean. They're just symbols. And what I'm actually doing here is saying something about what they're supposed to mean. Now, of course, I use the symbols, the plus symbol and the times symbol, because it's carrying meaning. It's supposed to tell us this is supposed to be interpreted as the function which is plus. But it doesn't have to be. We could interpret it in any way. All right, I could also, I could get another example of a structure for the language of rings would be the integers. I'll write that as z. So that's the integers with the standard interpretations of the symbols. I could also interpret them as in the finite field with p elements. Say, let me call that z sub p, and I guess so z mod p, where p is a prime. And then the addition would be interpreted as addition mod p, multiplication as multiplication mod p, and 0 and 1 as 0 and 1. Okay, so there's another structure for the language of rings. All right, now, once I have the structure, I can start to see how structures are related to each other. So if I have two structures in the same, which might be, well, I can do two things, okay. So I can change the language, as we've seen, we have examples where we change the language, or I can change the universe, I can change the set. So here I have R and Z, both as structures in the language of rings. I also have the language of rings or the language of ordered rings, and there's some relationship between those. And so we can look at kind of the subset relation according to those two different sorts of categories. So if I have two structures in different languages, so let's suppose I have M, which is the set M in some language L, and then I have a structure M prime, which is the same set, but in a different language. So I say, look at the language of rings versus the language of ordered rings, I put in the ordering, where here L is a subset of L prime, I guess it could be equal to. Then in this case, I'll say we have a reduct or an expansion. So here, M is a reduct of M prime, or the other way around, M prime is an expansion of M. So if I change the language, then I'll talk about a reduct versus an expansion. And I won't be doing this too often, except that we do have to, you know, for the example of O-minimal geometry, we need to be concerned with both the language of rings and the language of ordered rings, so whether or not we put in the ordering. And there's one more very common reduct that we'll talk about, or an expansion, which I'll get to in a second. Okay, then the other possibility is I might instead change the set, but keep the language the same. So if I have M is a set M in the language L, and I have another structure N, where I take the set N and the same language, and of course I have M as a subset of N, and M is a subset of N, so I have two structures for which the universe of one is a subset of the other, then we call this situation a substructure, provided the symbols of the language are interpreted in the same way, going down to the substructure. So this is then M is a substructure of N, and I'll write that with the subset symbol, but we have to remember it has some further content to it. So I'll write M a substructure of N like this. If the symbols of the language have the same interpretation in each of the universes. Okay, so I mean, we can write that out formally. Did I write it out formally? No, I didn't. Okay. But let's just look over here. If I go from R to Z, then, of course, I do have a subset relation, and the symbols of the language are interpreted in the same way. So the zero symbol is interpreted in R as the set zero, as the element zero, and it's also interpreted in Z as the element zero, so it's the same interpretation. The plus symbol is interpreted in the same way. So in this example, the structure R is the structure Z is a substructure of the structure R. But when I go down to the integers mod p, if I take this to be just the set 0, 1 up to p minus 1, I have the subset relation, but I don't have the substructure relation because the symbols are interpreted differently. Okay, so ZP is not a substructure of R. And this is the same thing that we always say when we talk about a subgroup or a subring. We should be saying with the subset is a group with the same operations. Right? We're insisting that the operations be the same. But we'll see that this kind of starts to matter in terms of what sets actually come up as substructures. And so there become subtle differences about choice of language depending on what you want to actually be a substructure as opposed to just a subset. And we'll see some examples of that as we go on. Actually, we can see one right now, which is I wrote up the language of fields here. If I consider R, the real numbers in the language of fields, I can make the real numbers into a structure for the language of fields, and then I would have, say, the rational numbers with the interpretation of the language of fields is a substructure of the real numbers in the language of fields. Right, you just think about if I interpret all of the symbols here in the standard way, then I certainly get a substructure. But the integers does not give me a substructure, at least with the standard interpretation of the symbols, because the integers is not a structure for the language of fields, because I'm insisting that there be an inverse function in there. So the inverse function, so Z does not give me, so Z's not a structure in the language of fields. Well, I should say, with the standard interpretation of the symbols. I can certainly make Z into a structure for the language of fields just by defining the inverse however I want. I haven't said anything about what it means. But with the standard interpretation of the symbols, it will not be a substructure. It's not a structure, so it's not a substructure. So that by, yeah.
Suppose we define inverse not everywhere as in the case of fields, you do not define the inverse of zero. So in the same way you have restorations, then you can define the inverse only for one plus minus one, and then it will be a legal interpretation, and then you can embed this.
Yes, so this brings up an important point, which is that we assume that our functions are always defined everywhere. And we insist that the functions be defined everywhere.
Okay.
Well, I can just define it. I mean, I will. What I will do is to define it to be the inverse function on the reals. I'll define it to be the inverse function for all non-zero elements, and I'll just define the inverse of zero to be zero, or whatever. Doesn't matter what I do. I just define it somewhere. Then I can, with this choice of the definition of the inverse function, it's not defined on Z. Of course, I could define the inverse function on Z as well, in some way or other, but it's not going to be the same function. So therefore, it's not a substructure, the way I've defined it. All right, so far I haven't said anything about what all this means. Right? Now, so we need to go on to do that, because that's where it becomes interesting. Right? So far I haven't said anything about how the inverse should be related to the multiplication. Okay, so I think I want to do that now. All right, just wanted to say one more thing about expansions before I go on to do that. So there's one kind of expansion that we very commonly do, which is to add constant symbols, because we often want to refer to elements of a particular structure or of a particular substructure inside a bigger one. So, for example, I might want, working in the reals as, say, an ordered ring, I might want to be able to refer to all of the integers. And so I just simply put in constant symbols for all of the integers. So it just create an expansion of the language, or of the structure, by adding constants. So if I fix some subset A of M, where I have some language, M, which is in the universe, which is the universe of the structure M in the language L, and I would add constant symbols to the language, for all elements of A. And I'm going to call this language L sub A, and that means I just take the language and then I add constant symbols for that particular, for every element of that particular set. And then I just build my terms as before, except now I allow these constant symbols. No, not necessarily. And actually, let me... Say it again? Yes. I not only do that, I allow for languages with infinitely many function symbols or relation symbols as well. I didn't give any examples like that. And most of the time, we kind of think of them as being finite, but they don't have to be. We can have infinite languages. And we'll have examples later on in the week. Okay, so what this gives me, so say in the structure of R, which is the real numbers in the language of rings with symbols for all the integers, then my terms are now polynomials and finitely many variables, but over the integers. So x1, x2, so possibly infinitely many variables, but any term only involves finitely many. So I can have, I get a bigger collection of terms by doing this. And if I then put in terms, I put in constants for all of the rationals, then I get polynomials over the rationals. Yep. I think I could call them polynomials, even if I haven't said anything about the behavior of the addition and multiplication. Okay. Well, that is what I mean. Yeah. Yeah. You're right. Okay. But let's kind of keep in mind that I have an intended interpretation. All right. And I am where I'm trying to go, and so my examples are directed to where I'm trying to go. So yes, you're right. If I don't say that my operations are associative and distributive, then it's not clear what I mean by talking about a polynomial. But okay, so now what we want to do is to try to give some meaning to all this, and first thing we need to do is to look at our formulas a little bit more carefully and distinguish between two kinds. So the examples that I wrote down at the beginning, in all of them, all of the variables are bound by a quantifier. So they all say, for every x, for every y, for every z, if x is less than y, then et cetera. All of the variables are occurring within the scope of a quantifier. So a variable in a formula is bound if it is within the scope of a quantifier. If it's not bound, then it's free. And we'll say that a formula is a sentence if all of its variables are bound. Now, if I have a sentence and I look at the way it's interpreted in a particular structure, then within that structure, what it says will either be a true statement or a false statement. So in any particular structure, a sentence will be either true or false. So in any particular structure, which tells me how the function symbols and the constant symbols and the relation symbols are supposed to be interpreted, in any particular structure, a sentence is either true or false. Okay, a sentence makes an assertion about some property of the operations within that particular structure. So if I take this example up here, let me call this formula, this sentence, phi, for all x, if x is greater than 0, then there exists a y such that y times y equals x. If I interpret this sentence in the real with the as an ordered ring, then the sentence is true. It makes a true assertion about the real numbers. So the sentence up there, phi, is true in the structure which is the reals in the language of ordered rings. And we say that, and we write R is a model for phi, and the symbol is true or is a model for. On the other hand, if I interpret this sentence phi in the rationals as a model for the, as a structure for the language of ordered rings, then it's false. Okay, so if I take Q in phi is false in Q, which is the rationals as a structure for the language of ordered rings, and so we write Q is not a model for phi, or, which is the same thing, Q is a model for not phi. Okay, so that will be the same thing. Okay, if I take any set of sentences, so formulas with no free variables, then they form, that collection of sentences is called a series. is a theory. We'll say that the theory is satisfiable if there's a model in which all of the sentences, if there's a structure in which all of the sentences are true. So it's a theory T. T is satisfiable if there's a structure in the appropriate language. Such that M is a model for phi, for all phi in the theory. And otherwise it's not satisfiable. Well, let me go on to that one. At the moment I'm just saying a theory is just any set of sentences. All right, finite or infinite. The theory is complete if for every sentence in the language phi in L, either phi is in L is in the theory or not phi is in the theory. Okay, so complete theory is one which tells us everything about, which decides for every sentence whether or not it's there. We'll say, okay, we've got a bunch of definitions here. I'll write T models phi. Okay, I just said what the structure models phi means, that the sentence is true in the model. The theory models phi if for every structure M, which is a model for T, it's also a model for phi. So that's saying that the if my theory is complete, then this is irrelevant. I don't need to say this. But if I have a theory which is not complete, then I'll need to say for some other sentences whether or not they are true in every model in which T is true. And then finally, I'll say that T is axiomatized by some set S, another set of sentences. Oh, this is the one that doesn't stay up. T is axiomatized by S if if S models T. Okay, so that is in every model in which all of S is true, also all of T is true. Okay, so I could say that a theory is a set of axioms, or else I could say it's just any collection of sentences, and I'll say that a smaller set is the axioms for the theory if they have the same models. So that's what I'm getting at there. Okay, so, oh, and then finally I need to say an example of a complete theory. It's a little hard to imagine right now how we could specify a complete theory. But there's one easy way of doing it, which is just to take all sentences which are true in a particular structure. Okay, so if I take the theory of M is a set of all sentences true in M, and the theory of M is automatically complete. Since every sentence is either true or false in a particular structure. Okay. Okay, so for example, of theory, I could take the theory of fields, all right, so I could I could either say, list the axioms for the theory of fields in the standard way. So we say all the properties of addition and multiplication that we want, and we say for every non-zero element there is an inverse, and all these things about fields. And then every structure, which is an interpretation for the language, for which the set, the universe, is a field, is then a model for the theory of fields. That's why we call it the theory of fields. I mean, I write down a particular list of axioms, and then to be a model for that theory is to be a field. But the examples that we already have show in particular that this is not a complete theory. Okay, so T is not the theory of fields, just call it T sub F temporarily. T sub F is not a complete theory. All right, we've seen examples already of two different fields in a sentence which is true in one but not in another. So that's an example of a theory which is not a complete theory. Okay, so that tells us how to understand the truth of any sentence with a formula with no free variables. What about a formula which does have free variables? Right, so if I have free variables, then so let's look at the formula psi of x, which says there exists a y such that y squared equals x. Okay, just take a bit of that, the formula psi, and take it out. So in this case, it doesn't make sense to ask whether this is true or false in a particular structure, because the answer is it depends on x. All right, so we can't say it's true or false, but instead we can say, well, for what x is it true? So then, if I consider x, which is this capital X is the set of x in R, such that the formula psi of x is true in the real numbers with its interpretation. Okay, so if we look at those elements x for which the formula is true, then I get a subset. Okay, and of course we get the interval 0 to infinity. So if I have a formula with a free variable, it defines a subset of the universe, which is those elements for which the formula is true. And so more generally, we'll say that a set is definable if it can be written in that form. So a subset of x of m to the n is definable in the language, I mean, I need to specify what language I'm talking about, so in the language L, if there is a formula phi of x in the language L, where when I write phi of x, I mean that x is the list of free variables, I'm taking a subset of m to the n, so the convention is that x is a tuple of variables x1 through xn. If there is a formula phi of x such that x is equal to the set of x in m to the n, such that the formula is true in the structure at those elements. So notice that this example right here shows us that the interval from 0 to infinity is definable. It's a definable subset in the reals. Well, that's not really surprising, but notice it's definable in the language without the ordering. Okay, so the obvious definition for the interval requires the ordering. Here I've defined it without. So we can see that a set might be definable in a smaller language than you expected it you would need to have. Now, I can also take this same formula and look at it at the set that it defines in a different universe. So if I look at the set that this formula psi defines in the, say, in the complex numbers, which is also, of course, a structure for the language of rings, then I could have, in fact, I might write it X of C is the set of, maybe we'll call that psi of C. Psi of C is the set of X in the complex numbers such that it's true in the complex structure that psi of X. And then, of course, I'll get, I mean, so I'm looking at those complex numbers which have a square root, so of course I get everything. But we can see that I can now talk about a definable set by talking about the formula which defines it. And then I might have, be able to say something, get information from that formula without having to talk about the particular universe over which we've interpreted it. So now we're kind of doing algebraic geometry because we're saying, look, it doesn't matter about the particular field in which I'm looking at it, what's true about, which comes just from the structural properties of the formula itself. Okay, now also, again, I might want to enlarge my language by adding constant symbols, as I did back here, and because we do that so often, we throw those in, and we say that a formula, that a set is definable with parameters if I can define it using some, adding constant symbols to the language. So X is, I'll say, is A definable if X is definable in the language L, in the language L sub A. So if I allow myself parameters from some particular set. So an example of this might be if I take X to be the set of X in the real numbers such that X is less than pi. Okay, that's sort of a trivial example, but this is looking at the interval from minus infinity up to pi. Now I need to have pi in the language in order to define that. So this is the set of pi definable. Okay, I could also do that with taking, say, the square root of 2. Let's say y be the set of real numbers such that x is less than the square root of 2. And so the interval from minus infinity up to root 2 is definable with the square root of 2 as a parameter. But of course, I could get around this by making a more complicated formula which eliminates, which doesn't use the square root of 2. Y is also the set of real numbers such that either x is less than 0 or x equals 0 or x squared is less than 2, is less than, just to be pedantic, 1 plus 1. And so then I see that this is y then is in fact definable without any parameters in the language of ordered rings. So we would write an empty set definable in the language of ordered rings. And this empty set definable is also written, is also said, it should not be written in this way, but it is said, zero definable. Okay, so zero definable means definable without parameters. Okay, and I see I'm running out of time. Oh no, my watch is 5 minutes fast, so. If we run by the clock over there, I can say just a couple more things. Okay, so I just want to mention the geometry of definable sets. So the definable sets are defined by formulae, so the and formulae are built up using the logical connectives and the quantifiers. So there's a relationship between the use of the logical quantifiers, kind of the connectives, in the way that you would expect, with the geometry of the definable sets. So if I'm looking at, if I have, say, x is a set of x and r to the n, such that some formula holds, and y is a set of x and r to the n for which some other formula holds, psi of x, then there are some obvious things, which is like the union and the intersection and the way they behave. So the x intersect y is the conjunction, of course. So phi of x and psi of x. Right, so, I mean, what I really kind of want to put the emphasis the other way around. If I take two formulae and take their conjunction, then what I'm doing is taking an intersection. And if I take two formulae and take their disjunction, take the OR, then, of course, what I'm doing is taking a union. Now, of course, that's obvious. But the one that, which is interesting is when what happens when we apply a quantifier. What does that do to the definable set? If I want to consider the formula there exists, now let me just write out, phi of x is the formula in n variables. So if I have, say, there exists xn, such that phi of x1, x2, up to x sub n minus 1. So what I've done, as I took a formula with n free variables, by putting on a quantifier, I cut it down. I only now have n minus 1 free variables. Sorry?
Phi is an
n-ary formula. Phi, yes.
You've only got n minus 1 derivative.
Yes, you're right. X, I need an xn there. But, well, yeah, but xn is no longer a free variable. All right, so if I said that by putting it in parentheses I meant it's a free variable, then I don't need the xn anymore because it's no longer free. All right, if I take the formula psi of xy to be x plus y equals 1, and then I put a quantifier on it, there exists a y such that x plus y equals 1. This is now the formula, there exists a y such that psi of x. I mean, x is the only one which is free there. You're right. The formula, the formula theta of x is there exists a y such that psi of xy. Okay, I'll put it in. Okay, but the point I want to make is that now I'm looking not at the set of x1 through xn for which this is true, but the set of x1 through xn minus 1 in r to the n minus 1, for which this is true. And so this is the projection of my original set x onto the first n minus 1 variable. So the existential quantification is a projection. Okay, I'll stop there, and I'll say more in another hour at 11:30.